You're listening to the Script Lab Podcast. I'm Shani Edwards. Today I chat with Timothy Greenberg, the showrunner and creator of the new Netflix show, Living With Yourself, starring the amazing Paul Rudd. Paul's character, Miles, is a man going through a midlife crisis and accidentally ends up with a clone of himself. Timothy talks about his work on The Daily Show, the long, difficult process of finally getting Living With Yourself to the small screen, and his highly regrettable experience burying Paul Rudd alive. He doesn't recommend it to anyone. Take a listen. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you.
So I'm here to talk to you about your new show on Netflix called Living With Yourself. Mm-hmm. It stars Paul Rudd. And he accidentally gets cloned, which is a great premise in so many ways. We'll get into that. But maybe you can tell me a little bit about your background. I think my listeners probably know that you won 2 Emmys for the work you did on The Daily Show.
How would they know that?
Well, now they do.
I don't know that.
How did you get started in producing and writing?
It was a long road. You know, in college, halfway through, I discovered filmmaking, you know, as a better career path. And I thought I was going to be some kind of scientist. And I figured once I took a film class, I was like, this is a lot more fun. And then I did a bunch of different, like in my 20s, I worked in games for a while. I went through, I had a software company and sold that. And then I took the money from that and just did drugs basically in San Francisco for a while.
As we all do.
Yeah. And at some point, like, it wasn't until I was about 30 or so that I finally realized, like, I have to get, like, what am I doing? You know, I had always wanted, at least since what I had sort of discovered it in college, like, I'd always wanted to, like, be a filmmaker. So I had gotten very far from that at that point. So I kind of sat down and started to teach myself, because I never really learned much. I love where I went to school, but they didn't really teach us all that much about how to tell a story. Or
where was this?
It was Dartmouth, and it was a very small film department. And I, you know, one of the professors there, Jim Brown, is I still consider a good friend, and he taught us like how to use the equipment and all that, and that was his job. But like, I didn't really, the screenwriting classes or whatever else either, they just didn't do it for me, you know. And I don't think I understood it. Really wasn't until around 30 that I thought, like, I don't really even know how to write or tell a story other than just what I sort of knew instinctually. So I sat down and I read every book I could find and then started writing. And it took a few years before I did anything that wasn't like obviously terrible. And then I made a couple short films, and some of that sort of started to, you know, I played in festivals and that kind of thing. And that in a very roundabout way led me to directing commercials briefly. And then I had a little bit of a reel. And then I saw this ad for what I could tell, they didn't say it in the ad, but it sounded like a, you know, writer director at The Daily Show. And I, like many of my, you know, cohort at the time were like just huge fans. This is around 2006. So The Daily Show in my world was just the greatest, you know, thing since sliced bread.
It was great.
There was no better there's no better place I could have worked, no better show I could have worked on, quite literally. Even though that wasn't what I like really wanted to do, sort of big picture, like I always meant to be more scripted, you know, making, I thought it was going to be films, but The Daily Show calls, you gotta, you know. And so I started there, and it just was a really good fit immediately, you know, I think in terms of the people and the subject matter and sensibilities and all of that. And, you know, after 2 years, I was like, well, I better get out of here to continue my career, and cut to like 11 years later. And it was great. It was so great. It was really just, no matter what else happens in my career, that is, well, very well might be the highlight. You know, it was just such a special time and all that. And then, just to finish the story of all this, well, you know, Jon Stewart told us that he was leaving The Daily Show, and I panicked and thought, like, oh my God, what am I doing with my career? Especially because at this point I now have a family and kids, and oh crap, you know, I mean, obviously The Daily Show continued, but at the moment there was a bit of a panic. And also I had been intending to kind of continue on for a few years. I'd been continuing to write and pitching some things around. And then the next morning in the shower, I remembered this idea that I had originally thought of as a film years earlier. And just standing there in the shower, I kind of thought, like, you know, this would actually work as a show. And here's how you would kind of break it up across the episodes. And I actually came to really like it much more as a show. Like, for me, the idea really clicked once I started to think about how you could break it up and then eventually kind of the different perspectives and all that. And I just thought that sort of all that worked really well together. And that brings us to here, more or less.
Great. Yeah. Miles, played by Paul Rudd, accidentally gets cloned. He's having sort of a midlife crisis, which sort of turns into an existential crisis.
Right.
Is that something that you relate to?
Yeah, I mean, all the time. But certainly, if you want to look at a particular period, it's good that we just talked about this, because like around that time when I was 30, I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this in a podcast, but like, you know, I remember at one point sitting on a couch with a friend who was visiting, and we had basically just been on a, you know, 3-week bender. And I realized, like, just because I'm sort of like a semi-neurotic Jewish guy who, you know,
my favorite
like
kind,
always, you know, was always kind of the one who would, he was always one of the good kids, you know, doesn't mean that you can't, like, you know, you can't get addicted to drugs and utterly ruin your life, you know. I was really kind of like, what the hell am I doing? And then that's fine. In a way, that's sort of a dramatic turn, and you realize, like, it wasn't a hitting bottom situation, but it definitely was like, all right, I got to get my life together. But then in the years that followed, getting my life together was not that easy. You know, I found myself being in my early 30s. I had done some things, but really not a lot to show for it. Meanwhile, friends of mine, in fact, one guy who's now my brother-in-law years later, were like very successful in the business. He's somebody that I had known at school. He was the showrunner of like a really successful sitcom at the time, you know. And I got to the point that I think Miles is, where just the gap between where I thought I should be and where I was just huge, you know. And there's depression that runs in my family a bit.
Yeah, depression is sort of a theme that kind of runs through it. And it's very relatable. I definitely related to it. And that feeling of, gosh, I thought I had more in me, more potential that I just somehow missed.
Yeah, I mean, I really do believe that you do have that potential. I think a huge part of it is just dumb luck. I mean, look at me. I'm a white Jewish male who, you know, grew up pretty nice, you know. Now, my parents, my grandparents definitely struggled, but, like, they set me up pretty well. You know, as I said, I went to an Ivy League school. Like, that's, you know, I had every advantage. And even then, it took a lot of luck to get where I was. I mean, there's a lot of people that had all those same advantages, friends of mine or people that I just know along the way that didn't succeed. Some of it is what's in you, of course, I guess, maybe, but I also think so much is just luck and situational. Of course, that goes to who we are. I mean, you get shaped from birth by who we are. And so, you know, I think that that's, I think that when we feel that gap of like, why am I not where I should be, whether it's because I expected something or because I see around me people who are rich and famous, or I see it online, or I'm just, you know, I find myself in a really shitty situation. Like, why is that? You know, is it me? And, you know, I think that often it's not, but you start thinking it's you, and then it does become, you know, this sort of feedback loop. Like, there must be something wrong with me, you know? And I think that's where Miles is when this starts. He feels like he's stuck. There's something wrong with him. Why haven't things turned out the way that he thought it would?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, that's, you talking about luck, that's a very honest assessment, especially in this business. It's a lot of being
so
the
lucky.
Best you can be, but also, you know, running into that opportunity that lets you.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many. I mean, now, look, who knows, had I not had this opportunity, maybe it would have been another one. And God knows, I bust my ass. I worked really hard on this. I was working at The Daily Show full time. I'd be up at 5, right? I'd go to The Daily Show, do was executive producer of The Daily Show. You know, we did a real job. And then I would come home, and after the kids went to bed, I'd write more, you know, and I did that for months and years. And like, I really left it all on the field, you know. So there's that. You need to try as hard as you possibly can. But it was also just luck. So many places, you know, where you look back and you think, like, had that not one thing happened, who knows, you know, maybe I wouldn't be where I was.
Well, one thing that I loved about the show is that you have two characters, Miles Prime and Miles Clone. And at first, they're very, very similar. But as the show progresses, they become differentiated. I wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about trying to write those two characters and how do you keep them distinct while keeping them the same person at heart?
I mean, on the one hand, I had in mind, like, here's what the difference is between them. The difference with new Miles is that even though he has the same memories as his other self, he didn't live through the pain. And so at some level, he doesn't have the same psychological damage that pain can do to you. I mean, there's actual, like, there's a drug that they give to, if you have certain kind of surgery where you're not allowed to, where you, they can't put you under, they will give you this drug that makes you forget this, like, the pain, which is insane to me. But somehow that disconnect is a real thing, and it relieves the trauma of it. And it's, in a way, it's like it didn't even happen. And they've been experimenting with that drug on soldiers and people with PTSD, you know. And they then, in conjunction with some therapy, they can remember. If I'm remembering this right, they recall the event while they're on this drug, and then they create new associations which are neutral. So later, although they remember the event, they haven't suffered the trauma in the same way, and so it doesn't connect emotionally. And so to me, that's the difference with new Miles, and I think it's a very valid sort of difference scientifically, let's say. How they get the cloning is clearly a bit of magic, you know. But another way to look at it is, one is you on your worst day initially, and one is you on your best day, you know? So that is, there's that touchstone too. And how would you act, you know, if you weren't filled with fear, or if you hadn't suffered pain and those kinds of things? Because I do think that fear is what gets in our way a lot of the times. You know, it can do anything from make you lazy, you know, laziness. I think a lot of laziness is fear. Like, you're just afraid to try, up through, you know, you're just straight up afraid. But as time goes on in the show, new Miles does start to suffer, and he does, you know, things do not go the way that he thought they would with Kate, and so he's unprepared for that. So when things go poorly, I think he takes a nosedive much harder than Miles would have. I think you get to see both the problems that come along with, you know, having suffered in life, but also the benefits, you know, that it does give you some defenses against things when things do go wrong.
So when I think about the premise, and obviously, like you said, the cloning is a little bit of magic for now. I mean, it could happen in the future as a reality. I would loathe to wake up to a second me. I can barely stand me as it is. So does that ever weigh into your thinking about the process, or is it exciting to have a second you to you?
I mean, I certainly wouldn't want a second me walking the earth at all times, but I mean, don't you think though that you would, like, if you could have that, I think it's Robert Burns, right, that says if we could have the gift of seeing ourselves as others see us, that'd be interesting. I mean, you may not like what you see, which is part of what happens in the show, you know, at different points. When it was written and when we filmed, and it just sort of slowed it down a little bit too much, there was more of that. Like, one actually looking at the other and realizing, like, wow, I've got, whatever, a second chin, or I'm just, look at this, you know, schmo before me. This is not who I thought I was. I don't know. I would kind of be very curious to be around that person. I also think it'd be instructive, you know. You have an idea of who you are, but I think we all might be a bit better if we had a better perspective of how others perceive us, and including our problems and the way that we might be selfish and those sorts of things. I think that might help us be better people, hopefully, if it didn't just crush us, you know.
Sure, yeah. I mean, like you said, you could definitely learn a lot, and it would inform you to make changes or
hopefully,
you know, emphasize the good things about yourself.
Yeah, hopefully.
So when you were writing the show, did you know it was going to go on a streaming platform, Netflix?
No, that was would have been my preference. But it took a long road. Like, we wrote the first two episodes. I wrote this whole big Bible. We took it out. We eventually sold it to IFC. And then they had paid me to write the entire season, and then they greenlit that.
Nice.
To production. Yeah, it was nice. And then 9 months later, it took a very long time to move the production forward for reasons that I'm still not totally clear on, but were very frustrating. And it just took a long time. And then eventually, IFC got their budgets cut by AMC Networks, who's their parent company. And so my show just went away. And then it was dead. And after all that work, it had been, you know, 2.5-3 years of work at that point. And I had left my job, and, you know, suddenly what I thought is, you know, I was going to have the show and just a whole new career is just gone, you know. Literally a single phone call and it's gone.
Did they own it at that point?
Yeah.
Oh.
And it was just a bad period. My mom, kind of out of nowhere, had fallen ill with lymphoma. And then shortly after the show died, she died.
Sorry and to hear that.
Yeah, yeah. It sucked. And I actually dedicate the show to her at the end of the 8th episode. And it just was a terrible time, probably the worst time in my life. And then we took it back out. And because IFC, you know, IFC let us take it back out. And they had been nice enough to pay me to write the entire season. I had a whole season. And then when we brought it to Netflix, they were able to see what the show was, you know, right there. And then when we went to Paul Rudd, he was able to see what the show was. You know, I think he'd been showed TV scripts before, but as he talks about, they see one or two episodes, and then that's it. And then the writers just tell you, well, it'll be fine, you know, from there.
Sure.
Where here, he could actually see it, and he knew where it was going. So it was, it really, I think that process, as unfortunate as it was, allowed us to end up at Netflix, which was absolutely, I think, the perfect place for it, and with Paul Rudd, who I think is the perfect actor for it. So it all turned out in the end. Although, we'll see what the actual end is, but yeah.
Paul Rudd is an excellent choice.
Yeah.
Tell me about why you wanted him to play Miles and Miles.
I mean, initially, just because he's Paul Rudd and I, like everybody else, it seems, just love him and would watch anything he's in. But he, I think, I've always thought he's a great actor and that he's also very funny. And this show requires both. It also helps a lot that you come into it with a lot of goodwill towards Paul. You know, you like him, I think, generally.
Yes.
And this character is very unlikable for a while. I think that once he gets put into this situation, you start to care about him more.
Yeah.
Once you realize, oh, wow, even if he's been a bit of a, you know, self-defeating meh to this point, well, now he's actually got a real problem. You know, he might not have had real problems before, but now he's actually got a really very big problem.
Yes.
And so, but in that period before you got to there, we needed somebody that you would sort of like long enough to keep watching for those 15 minutes. And so I think having him helped that a lot.
Yeah, and I love that the first instinct is to send the clone away, right?
Mm, yeah.
And just get out.
Yeah.
And then that doesn't work out.
Yeah.
And the two are now bound together. And I think that's, you know, was a really powerful moment in the show because, of course, your first instinct in anything is to just chew it away, you know, right. Anything hard. You're like, how do I get rid of it, you know? And then it actually starts to benefit him at a certain point.
So yeah, and then it starts to not benefit right. him. And yeah, yeah. I mean, I just, as far as that, I just kind of logically thought, like, how would you react, you know? Or how would these characters react? And what comes from that? And that is kind of how the story developed.
Sure. When you knew you were going to do it for Netflix, did you have to make any changes because you knew people would potentially binge the show?
You know, not a lot. First of all, I had written sort of slightly more condensed versions for IFC. Well, it's kind of a long story. Originally, we had 10 episodes. Then we condensed it to 8, which was definitely a good thing. There were a few changes, just more having to do with resources. But as far as the streaming, the trick with that, and I'm starting to see it now that like reviews are coming back, is that you don't have control over the period of time at which people are watching it, you know? So I see some reviewers who clearly were forced to sit down and watch all 8 right in a row. And it is certainly intended to be bingeable and to kind of move quickly. You know, that was kind of a touchstone all along. But for me, at least, watching 8 episodes back to back is just too much, you know? And we were told that people generally watch 2 to 3. So that was what we had in mind, you know, in terms of the pacing and that kind of thing, was that we're going to imagine people watching 2 to 3 of these. But it's tricky because if people choose to watch more, well, then that kind of changes the way that you ingest the story, you know. And it is a very linear story. I mean, people have compared it to like a very long movie, which if it were a movie, I'd do it differently, you know. But it's not a movie. It's this. So it's a little tricky to know exactly how to break it up. I mean, unless if you really... You've seen some shows that are very bingeable, like let's say Dead to Me, right? I think it's very bingeable, but to me those units are a little more, I don't know why I think this, but it just somehow it feels to me like those units are a little more discreet, you know? Like I can watch one and then even though I really want to watch the next, I can still watch one and sort of be satisfied. With this, I feel like the stories are really one moves right into the other, you know? So it's sort of how do you handle that both connection, but where there's going to be breaks for people, and it's like, you know, it's interesting, and I don't know that we completely figured it out, but it's part of what's fun about writing for a streamer.
Yeah, I mean, it's something, it's a new world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not that new now, but, you know, it's something a writer never had to really think about, you know, before streaming. So say I'm a young writer, I think I want to write for TV. Mm-hmm. What do you recommend? Do you have any advice?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best advice is just do it. Meaning, you know, first of all, you can't take my career path as any model. But I think that's true for many careers. You know, like you never know what's going to happen looking forward. In reverse, you see the path, but you can never possibly imagine what's going to happen looking forward. So all you can do is control what you can control and try to, you know, put yourself out there and... You know, there's you do not know what opportunities are going to come your way. So one thing to do is to write, say, a spec of a show you like, or write a spec of an idea of your own, and just keep doing that. Try to make it as good as you can. You know, don't just write it and then it's okay, and then say, oh well, I guess I'm no good. You know, make it better. I mean, everything is a process of rewriting. God knows, you know. And that way, when you do have an opportunity sometime, you know, if you're a young writer and maybe you're, you know, it depends where in the world you are, but if you are in a place where it's the business is around and maybe you're an assistant to somebody who gets coffee, you know, but then around the coffee machine one day, somebody says like something that gives you an opening to say, well, actually, I'm a writer too. And then maybe they'll ask to see something. And then if you've been trying for a while, maybe you have something that's actually pretty good. And that's kind of how it works, you know? Or like me, you just kind of write and don't really show anybody for a long time. And then eventually you come across something that you really feel like this definitely should work. And then you show somebody and then it actually it does work, you know? But either way, I think just doing the writing and getting in the practice and the habit and just getting better and learning what you like and learning what you're good at. I think is where it all starts, you know. I mean, now it's the same thing for me now. You know, I'm still writing, I don't know, a number of different things with varying degrees of likelihood that they might get made. Some of them are they're never going to get made, but I like it, so I'm writing it, you know. Other things are very specific, like I'm getting paid to do it, and it's just a spectrum of that.
Do you have any funny stories from set that you can share?
Well, I can tell you one. It's kind of the opposite of funny.
That's fine.
So right at the beginning, we were shooting in the fall, heading into the winter.
Of last year,
yeah. And this is in New York. So it gets cold, you know, and we finished in February. So all those scenes where Paul is walking around in a diaper, we did first, you know. And this is... I've, you know, at that point, I've been working with Paul for a bit, and he's a great guy, but I don't know him that well. and he's Paul Rudd, and he's a big star, and who am I? And now suddenly, because of the things I've written, we have him walking around at night, and it just because we did it in the fall, it didn't help any. It was freezing, and he's out there freezing his ass off in his diaper, and we just started shooting, and I'm thinking like, oh God, like this is, how did we end up here? And then that's like the first couple nights, and included some stunts that were kind of dangerous. And then on the last night of shooting in this one area, that's when we go and we bury him alive in the forest. And it's pretty much like it looks. I mean, we buried him, you know, there was no magic. There wasn't any special, like we dug a hole, covered him with plastic. He had a little tiny breathing tube that was like the thing, like the tube that you would have for a fish tank, you know, that he would breathe through, and then we bury him. I mean, it was so, I kept looking around at people like, is this how Hollywood does things? This is crazy. Where's the special effects for this? Like, we're burying this guy, and I'm staring at him, and it's like not, you should not bury people who are alive. Like, I don't care if you have stunt guys around who are there to pull the person out. Like, there's just something very wrong about it. And I really, you know, at The Daily Show, out in the field, we had done some pretty sketchy, dangerous things over the years that, you know, we never really told the home base about. But this was one of the worst things that I've ever been a part of. Like, just to have to stand there and go like, oh my God. First of all, it looks like we're burying him alive. And then you take the hose out, and now he's holding his breath, and we call it action. And then we do this big camera move. And you don't know what's going on under there, you know? And you hope he's going to be fine, but you don't know. And it's the first few days, and like, oh my God, am I going to be the guy who killed Paul Rudd? And it was horrible. And then we did it four times. And I mean, God bless him that he was willing to do it again and again. But it was just, I'm sure it was worse for him than it was for me. But it was really bad for me. Like, I'm never going to write that scene again unless we shoot it a very different way, because it was an uncool experience. Do not want to do that. Do not try that at home. It was so horrible. So horrible.
Well, I will say it is one of the best TV show openings I have seen in my entire life.
Oh, thank you.
So, you took the risk. You got the rewards.
All right.
Thanks. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, I wish you the absolute best.
Thanks.
With Living With Yourself on Netflix, starring Paul Rudd. And when do you know if you have a season two?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, Netflix is famous for not telling you anything until after their data comes in.
Mm.
But it's more than one piece of the puzzle. I mean, Paul is a very busy guy. And, you know, I think we all have to feel like there's some new iteration of it that's worth doing. So, I don't know. We'll see.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Okay.